You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Here on the West Coast, and I'm privileged to be joined by the Director of Strategy at Boulder Crest, and that is Josh Goldberg. So, Josh, first of all, I'm taking a lot of heat in the email for being Dolly Downer this morning. So let me start by apologizing for being such a downer, but I'm not gonna lie, I'm a bit concerned, and but welcome to the program. Thanks for doing this.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate being on.
All right. The first of all, let's introduce you. Josh is the Director of Strategy at Boulder Crest Retreat. So, Josh, talk to me. First of all, we got to learn about you. Born and raised where?
Born in Virginia, but raised in Dallas, Texas, and a huge Cowboys fan.
Do we have to go there?
We don't, because it's a little raw. It's still raw. It'll be raw.
Are you kidding? You guys have done better than you've done in the last 20 years. How could it be raw?
I have no. All I get is incredible hope for the future. So that I'm excited. I don't have a lot to complain about. It was a punch in the stomach ending, but yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm a Patriots fan, but
that was a bit of a surprise. Tom Brady, yeah. Though, not bad. Not bad, though.
No, have to respect him.
So born and raised there, where do you go to college, and what do you major in, and what direction is your life pointed in before you cross paths with this business that you've got yourself involved in?
Absolutely. So I went to Tufts University up in Massachusetts, up near Harvard, and studied international relations up there. And I like to say I was raised as an indoor Jew. And an indoor Jew is somebody who uses their head and not their hands, right? So I'm taught to get a profession, to achieve, to make the family proud. And there's there's historical reasons why Jews want to have professions that are critical to societies, because we haven't always done that well. And, so that was the track I followed. So I got my degree, moved over to London, New Zealand, worked in the tobacco business doing social responsibility and communications work, and then came back to Dallas and worked at ExxonMobil for Rex Tillerson, and I did that for 6 years, and I was incredibly well trained. I was incredibly, experienced, and I was exposed to things that I am grateful for to this day. And in many ways, Exxon runs their ship like the Army. I think it's probably the best analogy. And so it's very rank based, very age based, and I was able to kind of transcend some of those limitations. And so I got trained well, and then I get to this crisis point where I just have this profound sense that the life I have, the life I live, right, has no resonance, has no affinity with actually who I am inside, right? And the best analogy, the simplest one, I was living the Truman Show. And it was as if someone had created a life and said, okay, here you go, buddy, jump in, live it. And that, that's some pretty severe tension. And so I started to kind of disentangle myself from, obviously, some easier than others. I left Exxon and I went to go work for a family office for a guy who was really interested in philanthropy. I got divorced, and I changed friends, and all this stuff was happening. And while I was making progress on one front, on the other, I went into a deep and dark hole, like into the darkness, the dark as the darkness can go. And really, one of the challenges in the civilian world is there's just no capacity to air that, right? You can't transcend the pretending culture of like Instagram, where it's like, hey, I'm really effed up right now. And so I had one positive inclination that whole time, right? So I'm like drinking too much, hanging out with the wrong kind of people, just, can't sleep and panic attacks and on all of the things that I think people generally familiar with that our companies struggle. And I was like, I should like help somebody else. I should serve somebody. And, a week later, I'm in Los Angeles after having that kind of epiphany moment. And I meet a woman with my brother, she's a friend of his, and she works with athletes and celebrities on, helping celebrities and athletes advance their philanthropic goals. So maybe creating an organization, maybe just plugging in with an existing one. And she said, can you meet with a client? I don't really know what to do with it yet, but I think you could help them. So a week later, I'm in Dallas sitting at the table with someone on the Dallas Cowboys and his wife. And his wife's a Gold Star sister. Brother was a Marine, Pat, who died in KA in 2011 in Afghanistan. And they start to tell me his story and start to tell me their story and start to tell me the story of the veteran and military community. And to be very clear, I had no connection to this community. So when they talk about the 99%ers and civilians, the only person in my life who had any military background that I'm aware of was my great uncle, who is allegedly an Inglorious Bastard and a Nazi hunter. Wow. And that's totally possible. His name is Bumi. And Bumi was like a hard man, but that wasn't like, you know, your great uncle you don't have a lot of relationship with. And so I just said to him, I said, I need to go get smart, right? I can't be an ignoramus and try to help other people. So I go away, I read up as much as I can about all these different subjects, education, healthcare, employment, and then PTSD and suicide. And I'm reading suicide letters and I'm sitting there in tears in my house. And you know, later on I would realize that the reason why is because I could have penned any of those letters. And I was that close to the brink of feeling like it might be easier to start over, whatever that means, than it would be to try to go back to the beginning and figure it all out. And in the process, I was exposed to some other organizations that were doing some work, primarily work kind of outside of the mental health system, because I had therapists and all that. I had medicines and had been through that rigmarole. And I went out to California and I was helping a group, and I was standing face to face with a 6'3", 250-pound Ranger Tab 82nd Airborne guy. And, you know, former Army, lifting champion. Right. And he just looked at me and he said, you seem like such a good man. And he seems like you have so much to give, but you're going to do one thing before you help or talk to a single one of my brothers and sisters. And he said, can I curse on the air?
Yes, of course. It's All Marine Radio, man. If we couldn't, we'd have to shut it off.
Awesome. So he just said, he looked at me and he said, you need to unfuck yourself. And I said, Roger, like, I got it. Like, I know. And I was like, how do I do that? And he put me in a chair, put me through a program for a week where I really had to make sense of how did I create a life that was so unrecognizable to me? How did I get here and where the hell do I want to go? And at the end of that week, and realized my first exposure to combat veterans are 8 Iraq and Afghanistan, OEF, OAF guys, like talking about the hardest stuff imaginable, from them losing friends and on and on and on. And it's like, that's my exposure to the military community.
Right.
And at the end of that week, I had a couple of realizations. One, which is, this is the cause of my life. If I want to be of any value to the world, I can make sure that whatever combat veterans need to thrive at home, they get. And because they are inherently more powerful, one of them is like 5 of me. So it's just the theory of impact. The second was that on the worst day of a combat veteran, they are a better human being. They have more character, more kindness, more service orientation than anyone I'd ever met. And the last was that I'd actually met a group of people who lived the values that I'd always been taught were valuable, like character and integrity and honor and support and brotherhood and sisterhood and so forth. So that was my commitment, and that's when everything changed, and that was in October of 2013. I subsequently met Ken Falk, who is the founder of Boulder Crest Retreat here in Virginia, and we started talking, and he said, you know, do you want to move to Virginia? And I said, hey, that's where it all started. And so I did.
The Josh Goldberg, my guest this morning. Just so in your own path, as you look back to during that week, and you look back, what did you find out about yourself that helped you look at other guys who've gone through a much different experience? I mean, because we would look at you and say, dude, you're a pussy, man. Right?
Exactly.
We would look at you, so how do you look at guys who are going to look at you and say, yo, pussy boy, what do you have to say to me? What did you have to come to grips with in your own life so that you could look them straight back in the eye and say, man, here's how I can help you?
Yeah, and the thing I probably held on to the most was this principle that times of deep struggle, despair, you know, being suicidal, is all about the disconnect and the distance between who you are, who you truly are deep in your soul, and where you are at any given moment. And I think the question for anybody is how do you get so lost? How do you get so far off track from yourself that you would rather actually die than try to figure out how to climb back all the way and tackle that journey? And I think that it's absolutely true. I mean, I would be a self-acknowledged pussy, right? The reason I'm strong now is because you know, that same ranger who looked me in the face and said, unfuck yourself, works out with me 4 days a week, taught me how to meditate, and that I'm surrounded by people who insist on strength. And I think that there's no doubt that that's like a more of a civilian posture. And I think what I had to grapple with was I think, how did I become so corrupted by external influences and activities that I lost sight of what was important to me as a human being? And, you know, part of my story is like my life on paper was beautiful. And my ex-wife's family was, I don't know if they were billionaires, but they were incredibly wealthy. I was exposed and I was corrupted by all of this materialism. And I think that's the difference between me and you and all of your brothers and sisters is, you know, the military is not a material world. And I think I just became susceptible. And that was my main concern, was how did I become susceptible to it? Because just because I conquer it once, unless I fix the hole, then the water still leaves the bucket. And so how do you sustainably and meaningfully create a world where you are always authentic and you are always true? And I think that, you know, one of the things that I struggle with when it comes to combat veterans is this idea, in some ways, when you come home, like you have to leave behind all that you held dear, all that was true, and try to become a civilian. And none of that's true. Like, you have to actually realize that the way you've been forged is exactly what we need here at home. And that just because everyone around you is not like that is actually the whole point, is that you have to realize that it's okay to be who you are and not worry about what anyone else thinks about who you are is not your business. And it doesn't mean you get to be an asshole. It does mean that you get to be strong and speak your truth and hold your line and walk forward with that military bearing. And I think that's, you know, I think part of what drives me to want to be around this community is that they have instilled strength and fortitude and resolve within me that most civilians don't get, because at the end of the day, and this is the sort of short answer to your question, we end up how we get trained. So I was trained in a family and a culture that expected certain things, and I fell into that expectation category. So I was the kid who did what he was supposed to.
Right.
And when I started to disconnect from that and did what I was meant to do, I think things really changed for the better. And I think if someone joins the military with a call to service, a desire to find a sense of family, community, and values, and integrity, and I think about the Marines in particular, right, and the story of one of my brothers here who was told, you know, walks into a classroom, the recruiter, and says, two of you maybe could be a Marine, right? And I think about what drives somebody to answer that maybe, to say, I'm one of those two, I think should never be lost, right? That desire for challenge, that willingness to be forged, to struggle, and to let it become strength, I think, is the issue. In the mental health community, writ large, our philosophy, and I don't mean our and when I'm included in that, is, oh, my God, you're struggling. Like, we've got to make this less impactful on you. And it would be the equivalent of if you're, like, doing the crucible and someone was like, and you're struggling, someone's like, oh, my God, this is so hard for you. We should just stop. Let's just take a break. Don't worry about finishing. Right? And that's not your way.
No.
But that's the way we are as a culture. We're soft.
You know, let me read you an email. Mac, listening to the discussion, and it made me laugh. I hope your listeners know that unfuck is a technical term in the Marine Corps. It is not a nebulous term. It is a very, very specific and technical term. And when you're directed to go unfuck yourself, you know exactly what they're talking about. So it made me chuckle to hear it.
That's
awesome. I haven't heard that term in a while. I love All Marine Radio, man.
I want to get that tattooed. Unfortunately, I'm a virgin on the tattoo front. We have a couple of ideas, but that's probably one of the things that'll end up in my body at some point.
My guest, Josh Goldberg, and so you come to this event, and you're seeing, you know, guys in various stage of damage. You're seeing the layers of it, from the experience to coming back, the medication, the frustration with different forms of therapy. I want to be that guy that everybody tells me they want me to be, that I used to be, but I can't get to him because he's changed. How do I become that guy again? I don't like this medicine. I don't like the way it makes me feel numb. I think some days I'm going crazy. I'm going to lose my mind. I understand why guys kill themselves, because some days it's just too hard, and I want to make it stop.
Yep.
Between the bad memories, and so into this world you walk, and what is your sense of how do you fit into it? How do you help?
Yeah, I mean, I think my sense, and there'll be people like, oh my God, you're not a veteran. How do you spend time with these? My sense is that if I was to capture the key knock of when people refer to fucking civilians versus just civilians,
right,
is that civilians are fake, right? They're inauthentic, and there's a sense that everyone's pretending. And yeah, there's some other issues about not living values and so forth, but fundamentally, it's that people are phony and they're not real. And I think to me, it's just as long as I'm authentic, right? As long as I'm respectful,
right,
and as long as I listen and I share what I believe without trying to make it equivalent, right? Like, I didn't go to war, and it is different.
Right.
And I'm not a wannabe soldier, sailor, airman, marine. I never grew up with G.I. Joes. It's not my life, right?
What?
I just see a community of strength.
You didn't grow up with G.I. Joes? What the hell did you grow up with?
You're with books. You're a Jewish kid. You grew up with books. You don't play army, you know? You're running small businesses with your brother that you're making up, you know? We're running what's the right business? My brother and I launched a business at 7 for greeting cards. You know, you're entrepreneurial. You're trying to you're doing that. It's a very different, it's amazing how different the lifestyle is that different people have. And I think, but that to me is at the heart of it. It's and when we talk about post-traumatic growth, and I know we'll get more into it,
right,
what I think is so interesting about it is that the notion that times of struggle are inherently powerful, right, which isn't foreign to somebody who's been through military training and combat. But that notion was founded by two guys who worked with bereaved parents who weren't bereaved parents, right? They didn't lose a kid. And so that requires you to have humility, because you have two responses. One is you overcompensate and you talk a lot, right? Because you don't know what you're saying. You feel uncomfortable and you just run your mouth. Or you sit there and you just listen, right? You're just present. And I think that's the way I went, which is I found myself humbled by the community of veterans and service members. And therefore, I was like, as long as I assumed a student posture, everything is fine, right? And not a guinea pig student posture, to be clear, right? And not, I'm going to try to fix these people. Just wow, what an amazing group of people and what an amazing impact they can have. And I think that's our approach, right? Every single person who comes in here who is struggling, who's trying to find a way to stay here, like you said, is that I see in them all the good they can do in the world as opposed to somebody who's hurting. And I think that's the point, right? It's really important to look at someone for the impact they can have on the world versus, if I looked at someone and said, oh, this guy's just messed up, then I'm going to pity that person. That's a natural inclination, which contributes to their sense of, I'm not worth anything. I can't be that guy I used to be. And, our struggle with the medication side of this is, if you go back to my kind of diagram of struggles, the distance between who you are and where you are, if you're way away from who you truly are, if you're miles away and someone medicates you, they're essentially freezing you in place. And so you're frozen in place. I mean, I've taken most of the medicines that people get. And if you didn't know you were on the medicine, it might work, because then you would just, I don't feel anxious today. And that's great. You're not I feel slow and kind of, melancholy. And it doesn't actually change anything. It just holds in place. And our belief is that, and I've been doing a lot of reading, we're really inspired by the story of the POWs in Vietnam at the Hanoi Hilton, which is actually called Hoa Lo, which is called Fiery Furnace, was the actual name of the prison, which is, when you talk about forged in the fire, is what an incredible metaphor. But the story of them and the Stockdale paradox, which really comes to what we believe, is you have to have a completely rational understanding of just how bad your situation is, and the knowledge and the faith to know that no matter what you're encountering, you will endure and you will survive and you will be better for it. And I think that is at the core of what we believe, what post-traumatic growth is about. And it's why of the POWs, they came home, 4% of POWs have PTSD versus 30.6% of Vietnam veterans, right? That's almost completely unexplainable unless you really dive into the story and learn about what leadership looks like and what these men did to create a community, to connect with each other, to be very brutally honest about the failures they had made, but not to make failures imply that they are a failure, right? So they may have failed, but they're not a failure, and that's the difference.
All right, Josh, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to go down that rabbit hole, okay? So before we talk about what you do at Boulder Crest, I want to talk about the POW experience, because one of the things that Josh and I have talked about, and I first heard this term, post-traumatic growth, in something I heard General Mattis say, or Secretary Mattis,
yep.
Maybe I should call him. he's speaking, and he's asked about mental health. He said, well, you know, I'm trying now to focus on what's known as post-traumatic growth, and then he made some remarks about it, and then I read a little bit about it, and very quickly as I started reading this stuff about Vietnam and guys that are prisoners of war came up, and then it doesn't, and then the other part that I read that hey, the Greatest Generation saw some pretty incredible combat, and they came back and they changed the world. They changed the United States. They laid the foundation for the world that we live in now. And it can be an experience that you go one of two ways from. And so there's no reason not to use it as a springboard to do great things. And so I want to go down that rabbit hole with you. I want you to explain what you're talking about relative to Vietnam and when we come back. So we'll take a quick break. My guest is the Director of Strategy. First of all, before we go, what is Director of Strategy? What does that mean?
Right. So it's a good question. So my view is, and I work with Ken Falk, who's our founder, on figuring out where are we going, right? And we have big visions and we have big ideas, and we can talk more about them, about where we're going, which is fundamentally to create a totally different approach to mental health. And I think my job is to work with Ken. The strategy part is, where are we going and how do we get there? And I do the same thing in all of our programs, which is, okay, John, like, where do you want to go, right? I want to be the dad that I never had. Awesome. All right, John. Now we got to figure out how we're going to get there, right? How are you going to get there? And so that's how I envision strategy. It's define the mission, and then the strategy piece is what do you need to put in place to get there?
All right. All right. So now that we know what he does, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll continue our discussion with him. This is kind of the nuts and bolts of post-traumatic growth. Our guest is Josh Goldberg. More of that coming up next on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Life in the military is one of service and sacrifice. For some, that sacrifice includes physical and mental injuries or trauma that will affect their lives forever. Please join with the American Legion in recognizing and supporting our wounded warriors and their families. We need to show them that we truly are a grateful nation. We cannot allow them to be forgotten and left to fend for themselves.
This is U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran Montel Williams. During my 22 years of military service, I had the honor of working beside many brave servicewomen. They are the fastest growing population of veterans, and they can be a great asset to your company. Women veterans are trained to take initiative, adapt to change, and they're quick to learn. If you're an employer or a woman veteran, call the U.S. Department of Labor at 866-487-2365 or visit careeronestop.org.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Boom, 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 clap. Yeah. 748. My 13-year-old told me that. That's Charlie XCX, if you don't know. That's right. When you have a 13-year-old daughter, you know stuff like that. That's right. And Rihanna, way better than Beyonce, okay? I don't care what anybody says. So joining me is Josh Goldberg. He's the Director of Strategy at Boulder Crest Retreats. We're talking post-traumatic growth and learning a lot about that. And one of the things that that you hear is when you get into post-traumatic growth, is this historical record of prisoners of war from Vietnam? And so I want to talk about that, Josh, and because, you know, one of the things that, you know, when you deploy and you come home, that you deal with is, you know what you've seen and experienced, and then you think, man, you know, and there's things that bother you. You change, whether you're angrier, whether you suffer from some depression or whatever way that you're affected. And then I think you get to thinking, you know what, there's guys who have it way worse than me, you know, and how the hell were the guys who went ashore on places like Tarawa, Saipan, Iwo Jima, how were they ever right in the head? How did they go on? But they did. I know because I met them. How did the guys at Khe Sanh, and I've seen a documentary called Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. They got hammered on a hill for 77 days by incoming artillery. And, you know, and I watched the documentary and I was like, there's no way those guys should be right in the head. No way. So then you kind of go through this, well, like, how does everybody not suffer from this? You know, everybody should have PTSD that is involved in combat at all. And it's like, okay, so why is this debilitating? Because a lot of other people can do this and not find it that way. So talk to me about Vietnam and the POW experience there, and why is it significant?
Absolutely. I mean, I think... you know, I obviously haven't been to SEER school, and I think, but from at least talking to a number of my friends who have, right, it's like the worst thing imaginable would be to be a POW, right, to be consistently right. tortured, to not know if you're ever going to get out, and just that kind of experience. And I think to see a group of hundreds of people, right, we're not just talking a handful, and to see a group of hundreds of people. I mean, this is a book plug, but it ain't my book, but it's called Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton.
Right, funny enough,
I'm actually going to meet with the author tomorrow, one of the authors, but it's an incredible book. And one of the lines in the book.
Hold on. Would you mention All Marine Radio and would you shoot me if he doesn't mind? Would you shoot me his contact information? And I'd love to have him on.
Absolutely, it's a woman named Taylor Kalan.
Okay.
Or
right.
Kalan.
Right.
But I will absolutely mention that tomorrow.
All right.
And there's a line in the book that struck me. I mean, I've underlined a lot in this book, but there's one line, and it says the men describe their lives as improved as a result of their POW experience. Right? And you think about that, and you think about Everett Alvarez. For 9 years, he was a POW, the first POW in Vietnam. And it's a guy who goes, and he's in isolation, and he's by himself in solitary. And his thought is, well, you know, I grew up poor, so I didn't have much. My dad was alcoholic, so I often had to find ways of preoccupying myself away from everyone else. So this is just like that. I've been trained to do this. I can keep doing it. And it's like when somebody – and so that's where mindset matters so much. And I think the story – of folks and who had an understanding that didn't take like this poor me, woe is me attitude. Like, I can't believe I got shot down. This war is stupid. I shouldn't have to be here. This is the government's fault, right? That attitude where you're externalizing blame and not forming an element of acceptance. And it's like, okay, this is a part of war. Now we got to figure out what it all means, right? What is the meaning of this experience? And the meaning is, hey, we're still in war and our job, our mission is to return with honor because we are still a part of this conflict. And so for years, right, that was their mission, figuring out what was on one side of that line and what was on the other, what they could give up and what they wouldn't give up and how they would handle it. And I think created this ecosystem of the ideal culture that I think anybody would be inspired by, because it's like so counterintuitive to think that not just that you survive, but, you know, in the stories, Charlie Plum is a guy who was shot down 5 days before the end of his tour, shot down, right? His hope is, I'm going to get out. So he gets out 6 years later, 2103 days, gets out 6 years later to go back to his wife, who, by the way, had moved on and gotten married to somebody else, right? So it's like it wasn't enough that he was a POW. He gets out to come home to his family, and his family's gone. And it's like for most people, you think, like, okay, that would just be too much, right?
Right.
But he didn't do that. Charlie was like, okay, I get it. I understand it. I'm going to move on. And he got married. He has a beautiful family, and he has a beautiful life. And I think there's just this sense of understanding that life doesn't happen to you. It just happens. And if you don't personalize it, and this is where Commander Stockdale at the time, is so incredible because he had studied the Stoics. And he understood the Stoics said one thing, control what you can control and don't worry about the rest of it. And I think we're so stimulated by so much that happens. I think it's really hard to do that, to say, okay, this is what's within my realm of control. And more importantly, when stuff happens, this is how I interpret it. Because ultimately, what anyone would say is it's not the event that takes place. It's how you interpret the event. And if you don't personalize it, right, as some reflection that you deserved X or somebody else deserved, if you don't personalize it, I think everything changes. And it gives you the freedom to continue to walk. And you know, and there's another topic we should get to.
Okay, hold on. One of the questions when people go through stuff is, why me? Why did God do this to me? And I will tell you what, one of the great books I've ever read is, it has a Jewish affiliation, by the way. It's called When Bad Things Happen to Good People.
Yeah, by Harold Kushner.
Right. My parents got divorced when I was in my 20s, and you know, my dad was in Major League Baseball. We had this very cool little family when I was growing up. And then it's like the Germans leaving Russia in World War II, scorched earth. They never speak again. They annihilate our family. And I was like looking for, like, why did this happen? Like, how could this have happened to my family? Why is it happening? And so I read a lot. And the thing that made sense to me, why is God doing this to me? Was his book. And his book is written from the perspective of a Jewish rabbi who goes to all these different tragic, you know, events, gatherings, funerals, whatnot, and he says, there's a purpose for this, you know. God, the hardest steel goes to the hottest fire. God needed him more than you do. All these things that people say. And then his son gets a disease, that aging disease, and he dies, I think, as a 90-year-old man at the age of, like, 13, and he contracts it when he's 9. So he watches the little boy, you know, essentially age and die. And he feels all these things that he said to other people, now people begin to say to him. and he completely rejects it. And the conclusion of the whole of the book is, we're humans subject to the human condition. And God's not, oh, McNamara just cut somebody off, or he just swerved into the diamond lane. He's not supposed to be there. Okay, your car is going to get keyed in the parking lot of Bonds later on today. He's not doing that. Okay, you're a human subject to human condition. Now, that's how, and to me that made sense. That God's there for your inspiration, to inspire you and to help you, but he doesn't have a spreadsheet on you. And so, talk to me about that's a huge stumbling block for people. Why me? So when you talk about personalizing it, can you help me out personalizing it in the context of the why me question?
Sure. And I think Kushner's book is amazing. And Kushner actually wrote the intro for a book. I mean, literally a book saved my life, which is ironic or not, which is a book called Man's Search for Meaning, which is a psychiatrist who went through the Holocaust, lost his parents, lost his wife, named Viktor Frankl. And if anybody's listening, he wrote it 8 days after he got out of the camp. So just think about that for a moment and think about that this book is saving people's lives. And it's that principle. And so what Frankl would argue is that at every moment in our lives, we have the opportunity to inject meaning and to essentially ask one of two questions. Why me? Right, where you personalize it, where you assume a victim-based posture, and literally nothing good happens to that. That is where destruction happens and where bad things happen. And then the other question is you can ask why, right? So what is it about this? And what I would ascribe to it, what I would tend to think, and we don't need to get into conversation about what happens next, because none of us know, right? But I subscribe to sort of Ralph Waldo Emerson's theory. And again, the cool part of all of these people is they all struggled mightily. They all had to reinvent themselves. They all went through the crucible of hell, of concentration camps, of losing a child, right? Of Emerson was in the family business of being a preacher until he realized he was a fraud because he was telling other people how to live and he didn't know what to do for his own life. So he went out and he said, I got to figure this out. So he went into nature. And what he said is that the purpose of life seems to be to acquaint a man with himself and whatever science or art or course of action illuminates the recesses of his own mind. So my belief is when we talk about this idea of struggle and returning to who you are and figuring it out, is my sense of the purpose of life is that essentially to piece together the puzzle that's within and really to master ourselves. And when you do that and as you do that, what you realize is that these events are merely catalysts that get you to do that. And I understand, man, I haven't been next to a dude and lost him, haven't get shot and haven't been my best friend. I haven't had that experience. Right, I've had my own version of trauma relative to my own relative strength, which, as we've established, wasn't very good. But the sense is, if you ask the question why, and not why me, but just why, right? What am I to learn about the fact that my friend was killed at the age of 24, right? Or that my friend killed himself? What is the value of that, right? Does it make me appreciate life more? Does it give me a greater sense of just how important relationships are? Does it make me be more authentic? And I think there's a selfishness to that, right? Like, it's kind of like how am I improving and gaining from this? But that seems to be the point of it all, right? Is how do we take the events and experiences that we have, however they occur to us, and use them to learn and grow from? And what post-traumatic growth is really a roadmap in many respects to help us understand that. But again, to your point, I think one of the things to do about it is to read, right? Is to read about POWs, read about people who have been through concentration camps like Frankl, because it does put things into perspective. And it's like, okay, so if that guy refused to take a why me posture in that environment, how did he do that? Why did he do that? And where did it get him? And I think that's the value of these stories. Just like Kushner helped you, right, kind of find some light in the darkness, that I think is the value of story. And that's where being honest and being authentic, it actually gives other people permission to do the same, because we're all hurting in our own ways. We're all stumbling through this life. And that, to me, is how you get to that place. And it's the value of these incredible men and women who've been before us, who dealt with different things, but gotten to similar places and struggled with similar questions. And we're a little foolish if we don't learn from them.
Okay. We had that discussion to set up the Vietnam experience. So talk to me about the data of with those guys relative to PTS.
Sure. So, yeah, so the top line numbers is they estimate about 30.6% of Vietnam veterans returned with post-traumatic stress. the post traumatic stress, so which is about the same number they estimate from Iraq and Afghanistan. And 4% of POWs, right, came back with PTS. And so,
come on, that's crazy. Yeah, that to me sounds 4%. Like the craziest thing I've heard in a month of Sundays. And I don't know why I chose that. But
it's
4%. How could you not be whacked out of your skull?
Right, and Max, I mean, in part, this is why this book is so powerful. Like, what I do is, you know, there's a framework to post-traumatic growth. It's not a mechanical model, like, do this, then do this, then. It's not like making a cup of tea.
Right.
But it has a framework to it. So I overlay that framework on here, and I'm like, holy cow, all these things existed, right? And we can get into the details. But the important part is this. It's not just that they returned home, right, without PTS, right? It's also this. They've been studying these guys for decades, and what they have found is if you take a group of naval aviators from Vietnam who did not get shot down, who were not POWs, and you compare them to these men, what you find is that the POWs have better, healthier, more fulfilling, more successful lives on every single measure, right? So it was sustained, which is the point, right? Their mission of returning with honor and being honorable never ended, right? And I think that it's so my frustration when I sit with folks who served and I just say, like, you know, Ken Falk will say the Navy made him the man he is today, right? He's
right.
been out of the Navy since 2002.
Right.
But the Navy made him the man. It made him a successful business person, made him a successful philanthropist, makes him a successful grandfather and a successful dad. That's the point, right? If you appreciate that you are part and have been through the finest training institution in the history of man, which is the United States military, not to train you in how to do stuff like shoot a gun or put it together, but in actually how to be a good human being, right? Honor, courage, and commitment. If you realize that the way in which you were trained to live those principles actually transcends anything that's on your body in any situation, I think life becomes very different. And that's the power of the veteran. That's the power of the combat veteran is, by God, someone trained your character. You're the last bastion of character-based training in the world is the United States military. And in the civilian world, it's dog-eat-dog. We get trained by E and Bravo, right, to want money, power, respect, and want fame. And you guys get trained in how to be a good person, how to be a good teammate, how to be a good brother or sister, right? And the rest of us are getting trained in how to, like, you know, achieve and accomplish and accumulate. And that, to me, is the real difference. And that's the stuff that it's like you can never – I mean, I love that you can't be an ex-Marine because that mentality is like – that's true. And reminding me of what my brother Kevin, who's a Marine, told me that they told him at boot camp, do not let the Marine Corps be the last greatest accomplishment of your life. Right? It's the first. This is a launching pad. It's not the end of the day. It's not the end of the game. And that to me is like what I think I would say to anybody who served is like just reflect for a moment on how powerful your training is. No matter how rough your experiences were, how much difficulty you saw, just realize that you've been through a crucible and through a furnace that is akin to that which these POWs experience. And then you can have the same outcomes as they did. There's no reason why you can't have the same sense of fulfillment and authenticity and joy in your life that you deserve more than anybody on this entire, certainly in this country. Sorry, I got a little excited.
No. Let me just tell you, Josh, what's exciting about the work that you guys are doing at Boulder Crest is I think for a lot of people who've gone down a road of being medicated and going to group therapy, it offers a different route, a route that they're looking for. A route that's not a medicated route, a route to a better place in your head, a route where people genuinely need what you have and what you are. And so to me, it's an exciting thing to talk about, and we'd be stupid not to get excited about it. So talk to me about, so you're a POW, and somehow or other, you find meaning and you make peace with this experience. Is that because of the conditions they live in? And I know this is called, I'm leading you to an opinion, which I'm okay with. But is that because of the absolute desolate and brutal life that they lived? They were forced to meditate. They were forced to find meaning. They were forced to come to peace with everything, to include possibly their own death on any given day. Is that because they were forced through that process?
See, but I don't think you can say the word forced because the stories, I mean, there's in the book, there's some stories too about like Korea POWs where an officer would have made a mistake that led to surrender, that created a sense of guilt on his part that led him to basically befriend his captors and treat everybody else like crap, right? And there are these stories, right? So that's what's distinct. It's like this isn't a POW condition. It could have ended very differently if not for a couple of things. I think one is certainly, you know, I've always believed, right, the man doesn't make the times make the man, right? We are not in charge of what takes place. And the only hope we have is that you have a Lincoln in power. You have a Stockdale who happens to have studied, you know, the Stoics and understand these philosophical matters in such a profound way. And our only hope can be when these situations arise that either we can summon the will and strength and understanding or we're surrounded by somebody who can. So I think leadership is a critical element of it. But the other part is that what they did, so you have two ways of going at a POW camp, either Lord of the Flies, right, or it's every man for himself, which there are countless tales of that taking place, certainly in Korea in particular. Okay. And then the alternative, which is I'm my brother's keeper, right? So it's Lord of the Flies or brother's keeper. And what Stockdale and what these men agreed to do was to be one another's keeper, even at cost to themselves. And, you know, there's one story where Sam Johnson, who's been a congressman, is an amazing dude, who's who talked about, like, I think he's 90 now maybe, but he's talked about, like, he would gladly get in a plane and go fly missions again. So Johnson is there, and he's trying to communicate with some new POWs. And Stockdale's on the ground trying to see if there's any shadows, if the guards are coming, right, because they're going to get in big trouble if they're seen communicating. And Stockdale quickly sees that somebody's coming, tries to get Johnson down, but they get busted. And this guy comes in, and he's wearing Second Lieutenant Air Force bar, so he's a liar, you know, Vietnamese colonel who's lying. Right. And Stockdale knows that Johnson is in their sights. He can tell. So what does Stockdale do? He punches the colonel in the face, right, knocks him out so that he gets in trouble instead of Sam Johnson. And so you have this culture where leaders, right, are certainly part of the experience, are getting tortured and everything, which matters, right? They're not kind of commanding from afar. But they're also have this principle that I am my brother's keeper, which I think is, in this day and age, is so profound. And so the culture they created, right, of honesty, of authenticity, of community, of never putting self-interest above group interest, I think, by the way, is what the military teaches, right? And this comes to a critical point, which is, and it's the Sebastian Younger book, if people have read Tribe, I think it's powerful. It's even more powerful to listen to Sebastian talk in person. Right. Or you know, I know you had him on the podcast, so I'd say right. People listen to it.
Right.
But what Younger's arguing is that the values that are inherent to the military community, the best of which were reflected in the POW camp at the Hanoi Hilton, are what military folks possess and are, in fact, true, authentically and psychologically true to our anthropology as human beings, right? That is actually how we're designed to live. In groups of 40, where everybody has a different role of responsibility, feels that they are valuable, and in the face of an existential threat. And that's what war is. So arguably, as crazy as it sounds, war is psychologically healthy, and civilian life is not. And so that's when you talk about coming back from deployment, it's like, you know, you like every time you describe, like, okay, and then they come home and then you leave and you come, and it's like the pain I feel not with going back, but coming home. Because my concern, and this is the point of how valuable veterans are, is that what you are coming home to has a lot more to do with what ails you than what you've experienced. And I know what I'm saying, right? I realize how severe that statement is.
Right.
But whatever you experience over there is less of an issue because there's a context, there's a community that helps to understand it if you're led well. And then you come home to this nutty community that Younger argues anthropologically is severely unhealthy and almost could be labeled as a disease writ large, as a society, right? And then the question is, how do you guys have enough strength to insulate yourself from that society to be of value and change it? Because that's my bet. My bet, right. My life bet. I will be doing this. If we talk in 50 years, if I live that long, my grandma's 102. If I live that long, I will be doing the same thing I'm doing right now. This is the calling of my life, and I will do it until I'm dead. And the bet I'm making is that we can ensure that veterans aren't just strong enough to live great lives on their own, like in their own subculture, but can, in fact, bring what you know to be true about life and what's true and right and healthy and correct to the rest of them. And that's my story, right, is that I'm a kid who grew up who didn't have any of those things, and I learned from you all, and my only hope is, like, okay, I got to make sure that continues to happen. For, like, I can be an ambassador, and I am, and I'm a fierce ambassador, right? We'll be the person who comes to me and wants to, you know, say, oh, that's so nice, you work with veterans. I'm like, you don't talk that way about veterans. It's not okay, right? You know, These are strong people. You don't pity them. They're not puppies. But I think that whole principle of what you all have inside, like, you know, so these pilots are said to have the right stuff. I would argue that's true for the vast majority of veterans, is you are trained to have the right stuff. And the POW example is just a reflection of, in the worst environment, you can make anything as possible. And what's cool, like I said, is these guys could have come home, right? They said when they got to the Philippines and they got released, they said, we are honored to have had the opportunity to serve our country under difficult circumstances. And then they come home and they continued to serve. And we see it with McCain these days, but we see it all over the place with these POWs. It's nuts. They could have said, like, hey, cool, right? I survived that. I'm going to be a star, give speeches, not going to do anything meaningful. They didn't. They knew they had to keep going, and they keep walking and keep reinventing themselves. And I think, you know, that's the story that should be the story of every single veteran. And I should acknowledge, I'm on All Marine Radio, but this isn't pandering, but it kind of is pandering. It's my military experience is one day, right? I did this program called the Marine Corps Executive Forum, which I call Marine for a Day.
Right.
And it was one of the most profound days of my life, to be surrounded by active duty Marines at the shooting range, at Quantico, at the 8th and I parade, the Commandant's reception, just to see the pride and the strength and the courage and the clarity of your community. And I'm like, God, just when you take that uniform off, never lose that. Please don't ever lose that. And I think that's my hope, right? That's my push, is to remind everybody. And like I said, I'm predisposed towards Marines. I get to work with two every day, and just realize how gifted you are and how valuable you are to the world. And when you don't feel that way, know that there are ways of getting to that place, right? It's not positive psychology of, like, you know, Stuart Smalley affirmations in the mirror kind of nonsense.
Right.
It's legit, right? You make sense. You got to make peace with this stuff to keep you up at night. But there's a good way to do it, and there's a prolonged exposure way to do it. And prolonged exposure way to do it traps you, right? Your story has all the power, you know? You're praying to your story to let go of you, and you can't do that. You just have to say, okay, what I learned from this? I went through this experience. This is what I gained from it. This is what I lost from it. All right, now I got to move forward. And I think that's the difference between a training approach that we take and a therapy approach. A therapy approach essentially traps you in the past.
Right.
And a training-based approach is like, okay, let's assess it, and let's move forward. And it does it in a way with compassion and kindness, just like, you know, you go back to the POWs, right? They call it getting on the wall. You get tortured. Right. And you talk about, like, a group of guys who, when they first went through, right, they would first break, right, for the first time, more than name, rank, serial number, date of birth. And they would have this deep sense of shame where they wouldn't want to connect with anybody else. And it wasn't until one guy would be like, hey, I did more than I was supposed to. And another guy would be like, join the club, dude. Right. That's the moment when everything changes, because the shameless. And now every time you get interrogated, you come back and you tap, 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 and you tell people what you told them, what they said, so that the next guy can help. And you let it go, and no one judges you. And, yeah, did you fail? Maybe, against the code. But you're not a failure, right? You sustained as much as you could, and then you let go. And that, to me, is the culture that doesn't really exist that well in the military community. And it's something that I know we honor here, which is, like, it's totally okay to, like, say, like, this moment brought me great shame, okay? Right? And just to let it sit there, right? And then walk past it. You know, because that's not who I am, right? I wasn't proud of what I did that moment, but that's not a reflection of who I am.
My guest is Josh Goldberg, and we're talking about post-traumatic growth, the concept of it. We're talking about some of the historical writings on it and viewing it. Email for you, Josh. Hey, Mac, I'm curious. I talk to civilians that have very, very similar experiences. Is it important for us to know that we don't have a corner on traumatic events in life? Certainly going to combat creates them, but there's all kinds of people, from first responders to rape victims to victims of violent crime, that deal with this. Is it important to know for us that we don't have a corner on the market for these types of feelings? Josh?
And I think that goes, and it's a great email, and I think it goes to the heart of what it means to basically be your brother's keeper, right? And I think, you know, what Frankl says, right, this comes all the way back to, like, the question of, like, hey, dude, Josh, you're a pussy, right? Which, I, like I said, self-acknowledge.
Right.
And it may, hopefully, in my past, is to say that,
hey, just to be fair,
yeah.
We do that in the military. And this is brutal, but I'm speaking the truth, so I don't care. When somebody kills himself, the first thing we ask is, hey, what did he do? Where was he? When was he there? Because we want to figure out, does this guy rate to kill himself? Because there's some people that do. But if you're if you're a pussy and you didn't really do it, and then and you whine about it, you know, we're just like, hey, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
Fuck that girl. He didn't rate to kill himself. He doesn't rate to do that. We know pain, you know, and whatever. He had his own issues that he dealt with. I'm not feeling bad about that. I mean, that's just him being fucked up. That's how harsh, you know, this stuff can be when you're looking around at people that I don't know, have their own reactions to it. And so, but when you broaden the lens to see there's so much more pain out there than certainly what we deal with, it's a much broader lens. I do think it has a little bit of an impact on you. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Yeah. No, not at all. And by the way, and I say that because, and I'm, like I said, I'm not, like, I have a good sense of self-worth. Took a long time to get there, but I do. So that's what I love about the military community, what I love about, you know, the Marines here is they're direct, right? So if you're not holding your own, if you're weak, if you're off, they will sweat you, right? They will sweat you, and they will mock you. But it's not with negative intention. It's not to break you, right? It's to say to you, hey, I see it. I see it in you. You need to fix it. You need to fix it. You need to fix it. Until you do, I'm going to sweat you. And that was what I needed, right? That's accountability, right? That's like you can't go around pretending like you're hot shit when you're not. And that, to me, is when it goes all the way back to the story of, like, unfuck yourself. It's that's the directness that is in a society that's passive-aggressive, right? But to, like, a Marine who may talk that way at a workplace, right? And it's like, oh, my God, I can't believe you said that, and someone's crying. It's like, no. It's okay to be direct, right? Don't be mean, but be direct, because that's what nurtures the hardest and strongest parts of a human being, right? Talk to the person you want them to be, right? Speak to the strength within them, and it will come out. But to this point, to this question, which is really a powerful question, is, so what Viktor Frankl, and again, he's the Man's Search for Meaning author, is in the Holocaust, right? So what he argues is that trauma is like gas in a bulb. No matter how much or little of it there is, it fills the space. And so it is absolutely relative. Like, your experiences are relative to your strength. So that's what I'm saying when I come back and someone would say, well, you know, how traumatic was it? Like, really, you got divorced and you had this and, you know, your mom almost died of cancer. It's like, that doesn't seem like that much, dude. And it's like, yeah, but it's all relative to what I could bear, right? It's the size of my rucksack. So if I'm carrying 100 pounds and a 50-pound ruck, I can't carry. I can't hump it. So that, to me, is important. But this comes back to the younger point. This comes back to the society we live in, which is we have a 30-year high in the suicide rate in this country of civilians in this country. 125 heroin and opiate drug overdoses every day. And by the way, heroin and opiate usually relate to someone who has low self-worth or no sense of meaning and purpose, right? They do those drugs to try to find that. And you have 30 to 70% of this country is anxious or depressed. You have 40% of people in this country can't sleep, right? So, yes, if you looked at that, you'd say, well, hey, those sound a lot like the symptoms of PTSD, right? Coping mechanisms, unhealthy habits, anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, right? Suicidality, on and on and on. This society is struggling mightily. And I think it's you know, in post-traumatic growth terms, successfully achieving post-traumatic growth isn't just that, like, you feel like you're on top of the world and you've climbed a mountain. It's that you have the capacity to lead another human being from the journey from deep struggle to strength, right? You see the people who are hurting, who aren't saying anything, and you're reaching out to them and you're saying, are you okay? Right? And then they say, yeah, I'm fine, right? And you just had an add-on that I thought was really interesting, because we know if you ask someone if they're okay, right, or how are you, the first answer is BS, right? That's just a greeting. If you say the second time, no, how are you? They will answer with the truth.
Okay, hold on. Let me play you a commercial that the VA does, and you're gonna laugh when you hear this. But here you go.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member.
Is that it?
Yep.
Right? I'm good.
Yeah.
Right? But.
Yeah. So you're not good, right? It's like, right? And I can tell you in my own life, right? And so I got divorced, and my divorce actually was, like, quite pleasant. I learned things later that were unpleasant, but what the hell did you do then? It doesn't matter.
Right.
So I went to France to meet my best friend, who's from England, and we go over to France just to go have some wine and just to, like, I don't know if it was celebrate, commiserate, whatever you'd want to call it. And I remember that I had been fine. I really had. And I was standing and I was staring at this field of vineyards. It was beautiful. And it just came to me, and it was like, you're not okay. And what I resolved that day to do was every time somebody asked me, I would tell them the truth. And the funny part is when someone says, how are you? And you say, I'm not good, man. People run, man. It's like they don't even, they pretend like they didn't hear you. They don't want to listen. They're like, all right, dude, I got to go. Just wanted to say hi. And that point, right, the fact that most people can't handle it is the difference between often a civilian and a military person, which is, I think, to be able to say, like, are you okay, right? To realize that there is something different about people who have been trained to deeply care for other human beings, which is the truth of the military experience. I mean, to sit with a man who said, you know, I signed up for God and country, but when I went to war, it was all about left and right. But you realize, like, that's as profound as a mother willing to give their life for their child, right? That is the ultimate in sacrifice and service and brotherhood and sisterhood. So I think, to me, there's two parts that are relevant about the fact that our culture has massive struggles. One is it's an opportunity, which is it provides combat veterans to realize, like, hey, you know what? It's awesome to go work with fellow veterans. I get all that. But there's tons of kids in this country who, if they don't get the help they need, they're going to end up in the criminal justice system, and their life's going to be over. And you can go and you can intervene and you can go to those schools and you can help somebody. And Mike Irwin, who's started Team Red, White, and Blue, who's doing the Positivity Project, is doing exactly that. He's training kids in character using social media and other devices. And I love it, right? Army guy. And the second part is it's also a really important consideration when people reflect on, quote unquote, what's wrong with them. Because it's easy to think you come home from war and you've been through some bad experiences, and people come home and they pity you and they tell you how bad these experiences are, and the therapists want to medicate you and constantly talk about your war experiences, which, you know, we don't do here, right? But the point is that you have to realize, right, is if I felt alive in combat, if combat was truly the best and the worst of times, right, then people don't really understand my experience, right? And I come home to this environment where it really is the worst of times. And so is it that something's wrong with me, or is it that I left that environment, had this experience that was profound, and then came back to that same environment, and I can't fit back in because I'm not at their level, but the people aren't above me because they haven't been to war. They're below me, right, in terms of well-being, in terms of sense of fulfillment, in terms of authenticity. And I think that's the story that never gets told, but that's the story that I hold true, which is that our society is incredibly – let me just say this. Every time Ken and I go to a meeting and we talk about what we're up to, and at some point in the meeting, someone may say to Ken, well, how did you get into this? And Ken may start his story talking about how he lost his mom at 8 and some of the experiences he had in his life that led him into the Navy and some of the struggles and the things he encountered, and he broke his back. And again, that's the negative side. There's obviously lots of positive in Ken's story. And someone says, well, hey, Josh, are you a veteran? And I say, no, I'm not. And they say, how did you get involved? And I tell them my story. And we're honest with people. We're authentic, you know? And I can't tell you the number of times, and I'm talking hundreds of times in 3 or 4 years, where somebody pulls you aside afterward or just sits there and says, you know, I've never told anybody this, but I was sexually molested by the priest when I was 8 years old. Right? And it's on and on and on. And you realize that so many people are holding on to stuff and pretending and have a story to tell and have never told it. And I think that's the part that reminds me that I have a responsibility to make peace with my story so I can share it with other people, because I know that there are other people who, when they hear the truth, it matters. And the best kind of example of this is I just got selected. I'm part of this program called the Presidential Leadership Scholars Program, which is a very cool program, and I encourage anybody who listens to look at it and to consider it. It's done by the Bush 43 Library and the Bush 41 Library and the Clinton Library and the LBJ Library, two Democrats, two Republicans, focused on leadership training. So I go to this thing last week in D.C. thinking, you know, I'm going to be with a bunch of high achievers. There's 5 veterans or service members in the group, which is awesome. But the 55 others are probably, like, resume-stuffing civilians who aren't, like, really authentic and who are going to just kind of, like, put this on their resume, learn a little bit, get to meet the presidents, get pretty pictures, and put them on Facebook and move on with their life. Right. And what I've found, at least my experience, because when people ask me my story, I tell it, is the most everyone in that room was incredibly authentic, was incredibly honest, was vulnerable and open and willing to discuss why it was that they wanted to try to give back to their community. And whether it was the guy who wanted to restore voting rights because far too many of his friends are in jail, or, you know, the girl who works at the data company that wants to help nonprofits be smarter, everybody had a story that underpinned the problem that they wanted to solve. And it was a reminder to me that, A, you know, struggle is inherently not something that has to stop your forward momentum. And B, if you create the environment as an individual of honesty and authenticity and strength, then people, that's attractive to people. They want to be part of that. And I think, it's a reminder to everybody listening that it's true that veterans do not have a monopoly on suffering and suicide. And it may well be even more true that the fact that this society is so suffering and so much pain, that may be what is more problematic to you getting out or coming home from deployment than the actual fact of what happened over in the war. And that's kind of a mindfuck, to be totally honest.
Josh Goldberg, our guest, we're going to take a break and we're going to go down another rabbit hole here when we come back. And Josh, the most intriguing part about, in my opinion, about what you just said was the country needs us. And I think that I think that's pretty powerful for veterans, because when somebody needs you as a Marine, you don't turn your back on them. Whether it's a civilian that needs your help, I mean, you know, we are taught to, the word that comes to my mind is we're taught to nut up, right? You don't walk away. You get after it. You help. You make a difference. And so to me, coming back, as you were talking before, you know, therapy is kind of an internal focus, right? And what we're used to is we come off a patrol, an operation, we conduct an AAR, we sit down, we find out what we did right, what we did wrong, we fix what we did wrong, and then we move forward. What the construct you're talking about is the moving forward construct, not the staying in neutral, focusing on these events, trying to talk my way out of them. And, oh, by the way, see that group over there? They really need you. They need your help. And I think that's really powerful, especially for veterans.
And if I could add to that,
sure.
That the most successful civilizations in the history of the world have been those that the most respected group of people in their society, right? Not the most revered, the most respected part of the society are warriors. And, you know, I am grateful. I know I heard you talking a little bit about politics this morning, and I don't really want to mess with that, but I will tell you that I can rest my head more easily at night to know, and I've had the chance to meet General Kelly, Secretary Kelly. I haven't met General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, but I would obviously give my left, you know, I would do a lot to do that. But the point is, I sleep easier at night knowing that those two men, and Rex Tillerson, who I know, who's also high integrity, Eagle Scout, kind of a similar mindset, that those three men have control of a lot of things that are happening in our government. I think that should remind every Marine to think that there are two Marines at the head of this government that are the ones who can keep us safe, can keep us out of the wrong wars. I think is a living reminder of what's possible, and more importantly, how necessary you are. Because right now, it's McCain, it's Mattis, it's Kelly are the ones standing up and saying, we can't do this. We need to do this. This is what's okay. And that's a reminder to me of like, okay, when the veteran speaks, everybody listens. And that's the story of the Congress post-World War II. And we don't have enough veterans in our Congress who are people who are the ones that are like magnanimous, right? Who just know what's good for the country and don't really care about politics.
No, that the country comes first. At the end of the day,
Look,
we're at loggerheads, but the nation comes first. There's real people out there that really need help, and I'm not going to fail them. And the concept of sequestration in light of that worldview is what we would call, we'd call it treason. That's treason.
Yep.
You turned your back on your country. You can say I'd give my left nut too. We're okay with that here. This is All Marine Radio.
All right.
We speak the language. Anyway, we're going to take
you for the permission.
No, we habla, man. We habla. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to continue this discussion about post-traumatic growth, with the director of strategy for Boulder Crest Retreat. And his name is Josh Goldberg. And, hang with us through the break. You're going to hear that commercial again, relative to veterans in crisis. And hopefully it has a little bit different meaning right now than it did before.